Matthew 22. We're going to finish the chapter. We're going to be starting in verse 15. But a little introduction. I want you to remember where we're at in the story of Messiah. He's ridden into Jerusalem on that on the back of a donkey. And this begins the 4 days. The 4 days of examining the Lamb. Yeshua was crucified on Passover as the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And if you recall, as it's recorded back in Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 through 6, and I've shortened it a bit here, it says, Adonai said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month, the month of Nisan in the spring, shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, and that's the day Yeshua rode into Jerusalem, from the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household, and you shall keep it until the 14th day. So how many days is that? 4 days. When the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs at twilight. So during these 4 days, from the 10th to the 14th, each family would have a lamb, and it'd have to be a perfect lamb in the prime of life, had to be male, had to be without any blemishes whatsoever. And just to make sure it's perfect, they watch it for 4 days. And it's during this 4 days that the Lamb of God, Yeshua, is being examined. Now, the number four in Scripture is always the number of witness, the witness of the spiritual to the physical, of heaven to earth. If you recall, in the creation, it was on the fourth day that God placed the sun, moon, and stars in the heavens for signs and for moedim, for seasons, not the four seasons of the year, but for the appointed times that God has given us. And we have 4 days here where the Messiah, the light of the world, is testifying of himself to us. And if you've ever been part of a Passover Seder, you know there are a lot of fours in there. There are four cups of wine that are drunk, two before the meal and two after. There's a place where a child, the youngest child who can read, stands up and asks the four questions. And if you do a traditional Seder, you'll notice that later on there are four sons, a wise son, a wicked son, a simple son, and a clueless son. And each of them has a question. And each of them gets an answer. And during these 4 days where Yeshua is in Jerusalem, guess what we have in Matthew 22? Four questions. So we're going to take each of these questions one at a time, and then we're going to go back and visit the Haggadah, the Passover Seder booklet that we use. It's been established from centuries ago. But let's start with question number one. Question number one starts in verse 15. Then the Pharisees, the Perushim, left and deliberated how they might make him stumble in the word of his mouth. They sent their disciples along with Herod's men, saying, Rabbi, we know that you are a man of truth and truly teach the way of God. You are not afraid of anyone, for you did not show favoritism. Now, all this is just to butter them up. They didn't believe a word of this, but now they're getting down to the point. So tell us your opinion. Is it permitted to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, why was paying taxes to Caesar a problem? Probably because same reason we have. Paying taxes to our government. Because we know so many times those taxes, that hard-earned money that they confiscate from us, that we pay in taxes, is used for things that we don't believe in, that go completely against our convictions. And the same was true back then. Once a year, there'd be this poll tax where every head of household had to pay this hefty tax to Caesar. And they didn't like that because it's being used for things that were contrary to the covenant they had with God. It says in verse 18, but Yeshua knew their wickedness, You might want to underline that word, and said, "You actors." Now, I know your translations say hypocrites, but you have to realize that at this time, the word hypocrites meant an actor, a professional actor who came out on the stage, had a mask on, read his lines, and that he was an actor. You're actors. "Why are you testing me? Show me the tax coin." So they brought him a dinar, a denarius. And here we're going to visit the denarius again. Remember this? We saw this back in chapter 20 when Yeshua is telling the parable about the men who are standing around in the town square, and the man with the vineyard needed workers. In the morning he goes in to hire some. Go work. I'll pay you one denarius for the day's work. And then later he goes out and gets some more. He says, "I'll pay you what's right." And then he goes and gets some more, and then some more. The 11th hour, 1 hour of work left, he hires more. Then when he pays them, he starts with the last and pays them a full denarius. And the question is, why does Yeshua use this pagan Roman coin in his parable? Why didn't he just say 10 shekels instead? Why does he use this pagan Roman coin, denarius? I think for the very reason that we see here in the illustration. Unlike Jewish money, which did not have an image of a Jewish king, the denarius did. It had the image of Caesar. This is Caesar Augustus we see here on this Roman coin. And we talked back in chapter 20 about how the denarius represents not our rewards in heaven. There are other parables that talk about that. The denarius represents chi olam, the kind of life God gives us. And the kind of life he gives us is like a pearl. You know, a pearl has value, but if you cut it in half, half a pearl is not worth half the pearl's original price. You got it? Either you take the whole pearl or nothing. That's what chi olam is like. You don't cut it in half. So whether you worked an hour or you worked all day, he gives you chi olam, this wonderful quality of life. It doesn't give by halves. You either have it or you don't have it. And what's chi olam? It's a life that's in the image of God. That's a life that reflects who he is. So he uses the denarius because it has an image of the king. Of course, it's a Roman king, but it still bears the image of the king. And chi olam is bearing the image of our Creator and our Savior. So here he says, "Well, show me the coin you pay the taxes with." So he brings out a denarius. And he asks a question. He says, "This image and the inscription on it, whose are they?" They said to him, "Caesar's." He said to them, "So then give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and give to God what belongs to God." Now, it's easy for us to miss out on the impact of what's being said. Because when he asked whose image and inscription, he was using words that were used in Genesis 1:26. God said, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." All he had to do is say, "Well, whose image is this?" But he used two words. Whose image and inscription, whose image and likeness is on this coin? Ah, he's talking about Genesis 1:26. So then when he says, "Give to Caesar what's Caesar's, and give to God what is God's," he's saying, this money has Caesar's image on it. Why you put so much value on it? Give it to him. But you bear the image and likeness of God. So give to God what bears his image and likeness. Give yourselves to him. Look how he took the brilliance, the ingenuity of our Messiah, to take this test that all of us would have failed miserably, I'm sure. He takes it and not only answers the question, but turns it around as a challenge to them to give their lives to God fully and completely. Because when you give that tax coin to Caesar, you don't expect to see it back. It's gone for good. So he's saying, give your life away to God. Let him have it. Lay no claim on it. This is what it means to deny yourself. We tend to think that where Yeshua says, if any man will come after me, he must deny himself. We tend to think, well, okay, I'm going to deny myself potato chips for a week, or I'm going to deny myself cable television, or I'm going to deny myself whatever. That's not what it means. It means deny your right to yourself. deny your claim on yourself. You are not yours. You have been bought with a price. That's what it means. Deny yourself. There's also a passage in Romans that I think might apply to us and help us as we wrestle with having to pay taxes to government and programs that go against our convictions. This has always been an issue with believers who live in foreign countries. You know, we're waiting for our kingdom to arrive. This isn't our kingdom. But until it arrives, I think Paul's advice in Romans 13:7 is very, very applicable. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. Honor to whom honor is owed. So, we live in a country. It has a government. It levies taxes. And so you pay your taxes. Not one penny more. But give the government what they tax you for and be done with it. Don't fret about it. There are other things much more important. So, it says in verse 22, when they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him alone and went away. So that was the Pharisees. Now the Sadducees come up to bat. We have question number two. The question is about the resurrection. And so they think they really are going to have him cornered with this one. Now, remember, the Sadducees do not believe in a resurrection. They took a hyper-literal interpretation of the Torah and only of the Torah. And they did not accept the prophets and the writings. That, to them, was not part of God's inspired scriptures. Only the five books of Moses. That's it. And they took this hyper-literal translation of it. An interpretation of it. And so if it wasn't in the Torah, they didn't believe in it. Well, the Torah does not specifically say there's going to be a resurrection. Now, it hints at it plenty. But to just come out and say the words, yes, there's going to be a resurrection, doesn't say that. So the Sadducees didn't believe in it. Now, you know, we often choose our theology. In fact, I'd say we always choose our theology. And we try on theologies, try to find something that fits comfortable, that fits with our ways. That's what we tend to do as human beings. We want a theology that's comfortable. Well, think about it. If there is no resurrection and no judgment in the future, what kind of life would you live? You could sin and there'd be no accountability before God in the future. Well, that's how the Sadducees were. And you might think, well, why did they get in the religion business at all? Because there's a lot of money to be made. The Sadducees were very wealthy. The priests were Sadducees, and the priests made a good living being priests. They had a corner in the market. They ran the religion more or less, at least inside the temple, around in the temple area. And they're making money off the money changers and those who sell the sacrificial animals in the temple. And they made a good living. They lived on the west side of Israel. That was the wealthy area of Israel, just like it is in Akron. And they lived on the west side. And if you look at a model of Jerusalem from the first century, these are mansions with fountains and reflecting pools. And they were the bee's knees. They were amazing. That's what the Sadducees lived. Incredible. And so this is a very comfortable theology for them. It didn't cost them anything. So they come to Yeshua thinking they're going to entrap him. So it says, on that day, verse 23, that Zadukim, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection of the dead, approached him. They asked him, saying, Rabbi, see how Moshe said, quote, if a man dies without children, and they're quoting Deuteronomy 25:5, if a man dies without children, his brother shall marry his widow and raise up offspring for him, unquote. But we knew of seven brothers. The first married a woman and then died, but had no offspring, leaving his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and to the third. And wouldn't you start getting a little suspicious if these guys are all getting knocked off by marrying the same woman? And it says, and then it ought to all seven. Now, when they say they knew, I mean, I'm they're just using an example of seven, because seven basically means completion. Just, I mean, she had a bunch of brothers. She married them all. They all died. No children. So, verse 27, after all of them, the woman also died. Now, in the resurrection that you teach and believe in this resurrection of the dead, whose wife of the seven will she be, since she had been the wife of them all? See how they're trying to entrap him? You see, the Sadducees, since they didn't believe in an afterlife, in a resurrection, in a judgment, to them, everything was absolutely, completely, and totally physical. And I know believers like that. Yes, they believe in God. Yes, they believe in Yeshua as their Lord and Savior. But it seems like their lives only go as far as the physical realm. It's like they have no aptitude whatsoever of the spiritual. It's like they have no discernment whatsoever about the unseen world. Like they're oblivious to it, as if it doesn't exist. Do you know believers like that? I do. Totally physical existence. Now, they may live good lives, but they're very flat lives. They're not very multidimensional. They're just not very interesting. They're not very beautiful because they're strictly physical lives. And that's how the Sadducees were. So look at Yeshua's answer. Now, in the first answer, back in question number one of the Pharisees, what did he quote? He quoted Genesis. Now here he quotes Exodus. And verse 29, Yeshua answered and said to them, "You are mistaken because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. For in the resurrection of the dead, they will not marry women, and women will not be married, because they will be like the angels of God in heaven. But as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by the mouth of God?" And here he's quoting Exodus 3:6. God says, "I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And then Yeshua continues, "He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living." What he's doing, he's taking the Torah, he's taking a hyper-literal interpretation of it, and he says, God spoke to Moses, says, "I am the God of Abraham." Now, if there's no afterlife, if Abraham is just dead and gone forever, how could God say, "I am his God"? He should have said, "I was his God." But I'm the God of Abraham, I'm the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God's not the God of the dead, he's the God of the living. Isn't that amazing? So though the Torah does not come out and say there is a resurrection, it's hinted at. Even as Brian was reading from Genesis 37, where Joseph had the two dreams. The first dream was they were cutting down and harvesting the wheat, and they tie it in bundles. And then it says Joseph's bundle stood up. Now when you cut wheat, it's dead, okay? It's dead. But this became alive again. There's a picture of resurrection. There are many pictures of resurrection in the Hebrew Scriptures. But we need to see the Bible the way it was written. Because not only is it saying what it's saying, but it's also saying a lot of things that aren't on the surface. We need to learn to look into the depths of the Bible. It's like one of the rabbis said, if the Bible only consisted of its stories, we could have written better stories ourselves. But these stories were there to illustrate something unseen, something from the depth, some things about God, about us, about his workings in the world. And we need to learn how to read the Torah. Okay, anyways, I'm getting off. But I love this phrase where Yeshua says, "You don't know the scriptures." I think they could have said, "Well, we know the Torah," and he would have still said, "No, you don't. Because you're just barely scratching the surface. You're not looking into the depths. You're not seeing that every word that God speaks has levels and layers to it. Learn how to plumb the depths of God's word." And it's something that you have to use not just your mind, but you must also use your soul and spirit to connect with the deep things of God that are being spoken. I mean, let's just take the opening of the Bible. I know I'm digressing here, but it'll take us a little rabbi trail. God gives the story of the creation of the world over a period of 6 days. And see, we make the mistake of coming to that thing, oh, this is a science book. No, it's not. God is not interested in us learning science, though a scientist will see there many scientific principles. They're there because, after all, the God of science is the same God who wrote the scriptures. But what you see there is a place of darkness, confusion, and emptiness, and then the light of God comes into it. The Spirit of God comes into it and begins to divide. And you bring order through division. He divides the dark from the light. He divides the waters from the waters. He divides the dry land from the seas. That's how order comes into your life, through division. Division's a wonderful thing when it happens internally, because you must divide. That's how you bring order into chaos. If your kid's room is a wreck, that means there's socks and books and clothes and electronics and dirt and everything just everywhere. So you get the dirt and you put it there. You take the socks, put them there. You take the clothes and hang them there. You take the books and put them on the shelves. You separate. And when you separate, what happens? Order appears. So in the first 3 days, you see order. But what you're really looking at is how God works in a man or a woman. He takes the darkness, the emptiness, and confusion. His Spirit begins to hover there. He brings his light into it. And then suddenly, things begin to change. As you look at those 6 days, you'll see the six stages in a person finally being created who's in the image of God. The first chapter of the Bible is the greatest gospel tract you could ever possibly read. It's on page one, where it should be. But if you don't know how to read it, you can't see it. But it's all there. We need to know the scriptures. So this is something we learn in our heads. We must learn the scriptures, and this requires time so we can gain this knowledge. Now, the scriptures say that without vision, my people perish. It also says without knowledge, my people perish. But don't you know people know the scriptures, but they don't have any experience directly with God? They don't really know God. On the other hand, there are people who are all into the power of God. They're all into experiences, but they don't know the scriptures. You have one of these without the other, there's danger. It's like salt, you know. Yeshua says you're the salt of the earth. You know, salt is made of two elements, sodium and chloride. Sodium is a poison, and it's explosive. Chloride is a gas that's also poisonous. You swallow sodium, I don't know which happens first. You die from blowing up or die from poison, one or the other. But you're going to die. You take chloride gas, you breathe it, you're dead. They're poisons. And knowing the scriptures without the power of God is poison. Even the Talmud says that the scriptures are like a medicine. But if your heart isn't right, it's like a poison to you. But if you obey them and love God and see Him in them, it becomes a medicine to you. Even the Jewish people have taught this. On the other hand, people want just experiences with God. This is deadly poisonous. It's explosive. It's like the sodium. One's a gas that'll kill you, the other is an explosive that kills you. But you put the two together, what do you have? You have salt, which is necessary for life. These two poisons come together, and they form something necessary for life. Keep it in balance. Don't let the salt lose its saltiness. And I know in my life, I have swung from one extreme, then back over to the other one. It's like a baby learning how to walk. I'm trying to get better. So I want to know the scriptures, but I also want to experience God's presence in my life. We have entire denominations built on one or the other of these. I hope Beth Tikkun is a place of repair, a place of restoration, where the sodium and the chloride can come together to make salt. You know? It reminds me of a little poem. When the year before I was married, I was up in Canada. I was sharing some of these thoughts back then. I was just a young guy, just starting to put two and two together. And this Canadian fellow I was talking to says, I have a little poem for you. And I don't know where he got this. I think he might have made it up. Says, if we have the scriptures without the power, we dry up. If we have the power without the scriptures, we blow up. If we have the scriptures and the power, we grow up. I love that. So simple. It's so true. It's so true. So let's move on. Question number three. Now, in question one, he quoted Genesis. In question two, he quoted Exodus. In question three, he quotes Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Somehow numbers got left out of here. But question number three, he is asked, what is the greatest mitzvah? A mitzvah is a commandment. And we'll pick it up in verse 34. Now, the Pharisees asked the first question. The Sadducees asked the second question. Now, this is a Torah teacher. Yours might say a lawyer. That's a terrible translation. Lawyer? An attorney came and asked him a question? Well, remember, what is the law in our English translation? The Torah. So this is a master of the Torah, a Torah teacher, a Torah scholar. Now, we believe he belonged to the Pharisees, but he's designated as a Torah scholar. It says, when the Perushim, the Pharisees, heard that he had shut the mouth of the Sadducees, they conferred together. A certain, and in the Greek, it's nomikos. Noma is the word for law. So nomikos is a lawyer, a Torah-er, a one who teaches the Torah, knows the Torah. Came and asked him a question to test him. Now, the word test there is not to test to make someone fall, but to prove someone, to prove the quality of something. So this may not have been really a bad guy, because his question is really very good. He said, Rabbi, which is the greatest mitzvah in the Torah? Now, this is a common question. Whenever there was a rabbi who is gaining a gathering, and he had disciples, he would always be asked this question, what's the greatest commandment? Because basically, they're always trying to take the commandments and distill them down into the greatest one. And there were other rabbis before Yeshua who gave the same answer. The greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your... And we don't know quite how to translate that third word. The Dalitch puts knowledge. I don't think it's a very good translation. Others may say strength. That's better. But we don't really have an English word for this. The word there is meodecha. Your meodecha. It's plural. What's meodecha? Let me give you an example how the word ma'od is used. If something is good, you say it's tov. If it's very good, you say it's tov mod. And so you're to worship God, to love God all your heart, all your soul, and all your modes, all your modeka, all your varies. What is that? I think it varies from person to person. What are your strengths? What are your abilities? I like the art school translation with all your resources. What is it that makes you tick? What is it you love to love God with that? See? What are you good at? What are your talents? Love God with those talents. What do you have? Love God with it. And notice how it works from the inside out. Satan always works from the outside in. God works from the inside out. With all your heart, levav. That's the deep seat of your spirit, your emotions, the deepest part of you. Then with all of your nefesh. Two words for soul, neshama, which is the inner soul, nefesh, which is the outer soul. It's the part of your soul that's most connected to your body, most concerned with the physical. So with all of your heart, so with all of your nefesh, that physical part, that your body, but then with all your talents, all your abilities, all your resources, but it starts with the heart. Okay? It must start there. But then he adds a second, and basically saying, you can't do the first without doing the second. He says, this is the greatest and first mitzvah, but the second is similar to it. Love your fellow as yourself. The entire Torah and the prophets hang on these two mitzvot. And a lot of people say, oh, good, I don't have to study the Torah and prophets then. I just have to make sure I love God and love people. The only problem with that is this. If you really love God, you want to know what he loves. What he likes, what he dislikes, what his personality is. He has a very definite personality. If you ever go to buy a gift for someone you didn't know that well, and so you might go to that person's mother or spouse and say, what do they really like? What's their favorite color? What's their favorite food? you know, Caitlin is going to be having a bat mitzvah here. I just saw her. There she is. Is going to be having a bat mitzvah the first Shabbat of next month. And so the ladies are going to be getting with her and her mom to find out what's Caitlin's favorite foods. And I'm sure potato chips is one of those. Pizza and potato chips has to be on that list, right? And what's her favorite colors? And so they're going to decorate and get the foods and everything that Caitlin likes. Well, if you love God, you have to find out what he likes. And he tells us what he likes and what he does it in his Torah. Don't assume you can love God well without knowing him well. And don't assume you can know him well without studying his word. He reveals himself in his word. But he says the second is like it. Love your neighbor, your fellow, as yourself. I came across this cartoon from Peanuts. I just love it. I love mankind, Linus says. It's people I can't stand. And you understand what he's saying, right? You kind of love the idea of humanity and the conglomerate, but it's your neighbor next door whose dog barks all night and you just can't stand. Right? Isn't that the truth? And sometimes it's the people who live under the same roof with you. You have the most trouble loving. I want us to look at Yeshua's quote from Leviticus. It's Leviticus 19:18. But let's look at the whole quote. He quotes just the last part of the verse. Let's look at the whole verse. It starts with this. This is what it says. Leviticus 19:18. You shall not take vengeance. That's a negative. Don't take vengeance. It's a negative commandment. Something you're not to do. Or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people. These are two things you are never to do. Take vengeance or bear a grudge. But, and then here's the positive commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then the verse finishes with, Ani Adonai, I am Adonai. Now, when he tags that on to the end of a statement, that he's saying that's an extremely important statement. This is part of my very personality. This is part of the very way I operate and think and feel. And he's saying, if you want to be like me, don't take vengeance, period. And yet we all tend to. Yes, Steve. By the way, if you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions or share comments. Steve, thank you for breaking the ice, but wait till a microphone comes to you. All right, and hold it close. Thank you. Yes, good question. Why did God set up cities of refuge? That's a great question. It's because God also understands our weaknesses. And God is not a pacifist. He does believe that a capital crime deserves capital punishment. But he also understands the passions a person may have, that if you kill someone who's close to me, my passion will come up, this natural inborn thing to carry out what I see to be justice. But God's also merciful. He gives you a place to go to, and then there's a trial. And then if you're found to be innocent, you stay in that city of refuge until the death of the high priest, and then you can leave. If you leave it before then, and I find you, then there could be trouble. It's very interesting to see this. There is this thing of justice in God. He is a just God. But remember, as we've talked about before, justice is something that's static. Justice is static. And I always use the example of a parking ticket. You double park. The fine is, I don't know, $25. If you only pay $24, justice has not been satisfied. If the cop says, oh, you got to pay me $30, justice has not been satisfied. $25, not a penny less, not a penny more. That's justice, then justice has been met. But love, mercy, those things are dynamic. There's no limit to those. So God does see justice done. But even that is always in the context of his love. It's an amazing thing. I wish we had time to go into that. But that's a great question. A good one to think about. Don't take vengeance. And we tend to take vengeance with our tongues. That's how we tend to do it. Or with our snubs, with a cold shoulder, with our silence. These are ways we tend to take vengeance. And don't bear a grudge. It really means don't sustain anger. Don't sustain it. Quit feeding it. Kill it. These are illegal. And if you think you can love your neighbors yourself while still having a vengeful spirit and bearing a grudge, then you can't. And if you don't love your neighbors yourself, I have news for you. You don't love God either. Because you see, your neighbor is made in God's image. It's a flawed image, but it's still the image of God. And if you are having problems with God's image when you see it because it's flawed, God says, but that's my creation. That's my image there. What are you doing to my image? Because I take it personally, what you do to one of these, it's like you're doing it to me. If someone says, Grant, I really like you, but then they find a picture of me and start drawing scars and mustaches and eye patches on it, I'm thinking, why do you tell me you love me and you're doing this to my picture? And I have found that this is a problem across every denomination I've ever seen, ever been a part of, ever encountered. Whether it's in a church or a synagogue, whether it's messianic or not, I haven't seen anyone immune to this. It is a human disease. It is a human problem. And God says, I want you to rise above it. But I will also say this. At Beth Dacoon, I have seen victory over this more than any place I've ever encountered, ever visited in my entire life. I have watched you people here really focus on not taking vengeance, on not bearing a grudge. Because things happen. When you have this many people coming together, things happen. There are misunderstandings. There are maybe a little snub or something that's done because someone's in a bad mood or just was negligent or you misread something. It happens. But I watched the people here make a conscientious effort. I'm not going to take any vengeance. I'm not going to bear a grudge. I'm going to love them anyway. And sometimes what you have to do is just absorb it. Just absorb the hurt, and then it dies. And we have to look at our Messiah. How did he respond when they're crucifying him? Was he up there and saying, I'm going to get you? He says, Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing. He's our example. He lived this out to his dying breath. When people come to me and they're all angry and upset because somebody said something, I said, well, did they drive nails in your hands? No. Did they beat you senseless? No. Did they pierce your head with thorns? They always get where I'm going with this. Did they spit on you? Did they mock you? Then it's like, what are you griping about? You know, it's child's play, the things that happened to us. Just absorb it. That's what Messiah did. He just absorbed it and just let it die. We have to learn to do the same thing. Swallow it. Just swallow it and be done with it. Don't be keeping score. You know, a limited dose of amnesia would do us all good. It really would. We could just forget sometimes. So, anyways, yes, Adam, I see your hand up. Let's get a microphone to Adam here. Thank you.
Now, I'm curious. The next verse is about not breeding together two cattle, not breeding, you know, mixing, et cetera. So my understanding of linking the two is that it's talking about the taking of vengeance, bearing grudge, is something that's antithetical to the nature of God. That's why he writes.
Absolutely.
So my question, which I know is a perspective issue, is how do we deal with when God talks about he keeps track? And like with the way God deals with our own sin, the way God dealt with Israel and those punishments. Because I think to the uneducated, I put myself in that camp, it may seem like there is vengeance or a grudge. So I don't know. I guess you can help me with that perspective.
Okay, great question. Adam's asking the question, how about God? Doesn't he take vengeance? Doesn't he do things? Yes, he says, don't you take vengeance. Vengeance belongs to me. I own it. You don't. Because you see, I'm not your father. I have no right to bring vengeance against you. But we have a father. And when a father disciplines a child, is it really vengeance? What's the purpose of all of the punishment he brings? To bring about the peaceful fruits of righteousness, Hebrews says. So when you see God bringing punishment, whatever you call it, when he brings punishment, it's a father's heart bringing it because he loves his child and wants to grow them up. And it says he scourges each one that he loves. Why? To refine them. And I think God's purpose when we feel pain like that is God is destroying in us the things that would destroy us if they're not destroyed in turn. And he wants to shake the things that would shake us and put to death the things that would kill us. And we feel that heat when he does that. But it's always coming from a father's heart with God, where it may not be coming from a father's heart between two individuals, two equals. Does that make sense? Okay. And I'm not wording it very well. I can see what I want to say. Just can't put words to it. Maybe Mim can help me out. Let's get a microphone to Mim right here.
Oh, boy. Just thinking about what you're talking about. When someone hurts you, or in my own experience, forgiveness is a very good healing process.
Exactly.
For me, and I know that many of you have done that. The Lord said he will be the one who will take care of every wrong that has been done. And we are to forgive the way he's forgiven us. I thought about Elizabeth Elliot. She went to the mission field, to the people who killed her husband.
Yes.
And that is something is freeing to us when we use
forgiveness. Absolutely. Who are we imitating when we forgive? We're imitating our Messiah. We're imitating God. He's a forgiver. And if you want to be like him, we got to let go of vengeance, the scores we keep, the grudges we maintain. We got to do that and love our neighbor like we love ourselves. And we do love ourselves. That comes pretty naturally. Well, we must move on. Question number four. Now here, this question is not asked by a Pharisee or a Sadducee or just a Torah scholar. It's asked by Yeshua himself. It's almost like he's saying, you guys are asking all the wrong questions. Here's what you need to be asking. Verse 41, when the Pharisees were assembled, Yeshua asked them, saying, what do you say about the Messiah? Whose son is he? And they're thinking, well, this is elementary. This is a grade school question. And so they say, well, son of David, Ben David. He said to them, then how could David, by the Spirit, call him his master? When he said, and here he's quoting Psalm 110, verse 1. Hashem, Adonai, God, the Lord, said to my master, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Now, if David calls him his master, then how can he be his son? Now, it doesn't come across the English where it says, then the Lord said to my Lord. In the Hebrew, it makes perfect sense. Psalm 110:1, it reads exactly like this, a psalm of David. Adonai, that's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, God's tetragrammaton, his four-letter name. Adonai says to my Adon, my master. And everyone agreed that the master equals Messiah. And David, who's the ancestor of the Messiah, who is the Messiah? He's David's son. So how does David call his son his master? So I think Yeshua just loved doing this sort of thing. He takes all the human limitations we all put on God. Now there are seven brothers, all married the same woman, then they all died, they didn't have any children. Whose husband? Whose wife will she be? I mean, they want to put these physical limitations on God, impose time and space on God, and Yeshua's just blowing it out of the water. He likes to take things and show how time and space are an illusion that only we perceive, but there's no illusion with God. God doesn't look back in time or forward in time because he doesn't dwell in time. He is present always, all the time. It's all there together. And so, God loves playing these little games, these little puzzles, just to delight us as children. You know, we think of them as almost like magic tricks, except they're not illusions, they're real. He says, I'm going to make this guy, David, this king, and he's going to have a son down the road, and that son's going to be the Messiah. But that Messiah is actually the creator of the world who created David. And then David is going to say to me, the creator, the Lord of the universe, referring to his son, that he's his master. That's going to be fun. And, you know, the Greek mindset, our brains start buzzing. And it just makes us crazy. But with the Hebrew mindset, we just delight in this. To take things that seem to be mutually exclusive and just hold on to them both. You want to know what the greatest conundrums in the world is? You. Your body's made from mud. Yet you yourself are breathed by God, Spirit. You yourself are this amazing thing where it's physical and spiritual. Put them together, and here you are. People always want to ask me questions about God and about Yeshua. Is he divine? Is he human? How? Blah, 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 blah. I say, well, just explain yourself to me, then we'll talk about him. Let's start with something small. Explain how you can be. You, physical and spiritual combined together. You explain yourself how that miracle can happen, and then we can move on to bigger things like who Yeshua is. You know what I'm saying? Oh, well. I want us to take the last few minutes we have and go back to what I mentioned at the beginning, the Passover Seder. And the Passover Seder is an amazing thing. It's been around for centuries, but the Seders we know today didn't exist in that form exactly back in Yeshua's day. But again, is God trapped in time? There's no question in my mind that God had his hand in how the Passover Seder and how the Haggadah was constructed. And he knew that, knew what he was going to do when he brought Messiah to the earth. And before they ever thought about asking four questions at the Seder, he had these people asking Yeshua questions. Three from them and one from the Messiah to make a total of four. Now here's I have a bunch of Haggadahs at home. I kind of collect them. This is one of my favorites. And everybody's going to be asking me where they can get one, so I'll just go ahead and do it now so I can save the emails. It's published by Kehote Society, Kehot. And it's simply called the Coleman Nakam Haggadah. Just you put the Haggadah, you'll see it on there. But it's really beautiful. It's fancy. It's got a lot of great commentary, but it's a traditional Jewish Haggadah. And some of these things probably did go back to before when Yeshua was born, but most of them are there from afterwards. But there's no question how things play together here. And at the risk of making more of this than what there is, I just want to introduce to you, put it out there, and then you can think about it. All right? At the Passover Seder, we have a young child stand up and ask four questions. And then we have four sons, who in turn ask four questions. And then there are four answers to the four questions. Everything's in fours. And remember, if you've been to a Seder, this is called Manishtah. Why is this night different? Why is this night different from all other nights? The little child gets up and says, on other nights, we can eat leavened bread or unleavened bread, but tonight we only eat unleavened bread. And then the second question, on all other nights, we eat all kinds of vegetables, but on this night, we eat bitter herbs. Why is that? The third question, all other nights, we don't dip our vegetables at all, but tonight we dip them twice. And then the fourth, on all other nights, we either can eat sitting up or reclining, you know, as they did in the Middle East in the first century. But why tonight do we recline? Why do we lean? But then you go a few more pages in the Haggadah past this, and then it speaks of four sons. The Torah speaks of four sons. Now, this is what it says in the Gada. Now, the Torah does not speak of four sons. But there are four places in the Torah where it commands us to teach our sons about what God did for us in Egypt when he redeemed us through the Lamb. Four times. So the rabbis, the way they do, they think, well, we have to tell it four times. There must be four kinds of sons we have to tell it to. Because you're to teach your sons what God did for us in Egypt. And so they call these four sons the wise son, the wicked son, the simple son, he's not very smart, and then the clueless son. He doesn't even ask a question, doesn't even know how to ask a question. Now, it's kind of interesting that when you look at Matthew 22, we have four questions. And obviously, who is the wise son? Well, that has to be Yeshua. No question about that. He's the wise son. And what does he call the Pharisees in the first question? Knowing their wickedness, it says. And then you've got two questions in here, which are really kind of dumb. I mean, really? A woman marries seven brothers, one at a time. Whose wife will she be in heaven? Really? I mean, honestly, the first time you heard that question, you think, that's really a dippy question. I mean, really. And it is. It's kind of dumb. So, you can play around with those. But let's look at the questions that they ask. The wise son in the Haggadah, the wise son, it says, what does he say? Here's his question. What are these testimonies, statutes, and judgments which God our God has commanded you? What are they? And he's quoting Deuteronomy 6:20, where it says, you shall teach your sons the testimony, statutes, and judgments that God has commanded us. So the wise son wants to know this wonderful God who would step down into Egypt and redeem his people and so many Gentiles, a great mixed multitude of Gentiles, out of the slavery. What an incredible thing he's done. And Dad, if that hadn't have happened, I wouldn't be here. If you had died in Egypt, I wouldn't be here. Or if I had been born, I'd be a slave in Egypt just like you were. But God redeemed you, and I am experiencing the blessing of that. What does God want of me? How can I give my life to this God? He redeemed me, therefore I belong to him. What does he want of me? That's what the wise son asks. The wicked son, he says, what does he say? What's this ritual to you? Yeah, what's it to you? What's this mean to you? What's the big deal? Why are you doing this? It's a mocking attitude. And then it gives you the answer to give to him. The simple son doesn't say, what is this ritual to you? Or what are these commandments? He says, what is this? What is this? I don't understand. Explain. The clueless son, what does he say? That's my own interpretation. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't even know how to ask a question. Now, in the Haggadah, if there's any explanation at all, they always ask this question. Why in the Haggadah is it put the wicked son right next to the wise son? You think he put the wicked son way at the end. Why does he follow right after the wise son? And the rabbis say, well, at the Seder, you take the wicked son, you seat him next to the wise son. So if he's going to ask smart alecky questions, the wise son's there to answer them and to add a balance to him. Don't put him down here by the simple or clueless son. He'll lead them astray. Put him over here by the wise one. You see? But go back to Matthew 22 for a second. Where's the wise son in that order? He's moved all the way down to the end, next to the clueless and simple. The wicked son asks his question first, and the wise son asks his question last. Now, the Pharisees, Yeshua knew their wickedness. The Sadducees, he says to them, you don't know the scriptures, power of God. So there's ignorance that motivated their question. They're like the clueless and the simple son. The Torah scholar is really asking the question, what is this? As it says, he asked the question to test Yeshua, not to test him to failure, but to test him to prove what he's made of. He's really asked the question, who are you? That's really what he's asking. And the Messiah asks a question himself at the end. Now, I want us to examine in the Haggadah not just the question the wise son asks, but the answer that the Haggadah tells us to give him. This is how it's worded. Let me find it here. The wise son. What does he say? Quote, what are these commemorative laws, super irrational laws, you know, these testimonies and judgments and commandments which God, our God, has commanded you? You should instruct him in the laws of the Passover lamb, saying, quote, we do not serve any dessert after the Passover lamb, unquote. What in the world does that mean? We don't serve dessert after the lamb? See, this is what people do. They read this and they act just like I did, like, oh, you know, what is this? I don't need this. And I know many of us, we put aside the traditional God, and even I made up one for us to use. It's a little simpler, that brings out the messianic insights. And some people don't want to use a Haggadah at all. They just want to tell the story of the Exodus. And that's all fine. It's all good. But I'm telling you, there are treasures in here. Centuries-old treasures. And there's something in Matthew 22 that tells me, don't ignore this stuff. God's saying, yeah, the rabbis put this together. But I was in the room with them when they did, and they didn't even know it. Here's the question. You should instruct him in the laws of the Pesach lamb. Pesach means Passover. And this is what you say. We do not serve any dessert after the Pesach lamb. Now, if you've been to a Passover Seder, you know there's a place there where they have three pieces of matzah, and they're stacked. They're separated by linen cloth. And nobody knows why there are three. It just is. And you take the middle matzah out. You break it in half. And remember, the matzahs are striped. They're pierced. There are little holes in it. There are burn marks. Look like stripes. And it looks like bruising. And then you break it. And it's believed that that's the piece of matzah Yeshua took when he says, this is my body, which is broken for you. It's pierced, it's bruised, it's broken. And you take half of that piece of matzah, you take a linen cloth, and you wrap that piece of matzah in that linen. You have the children hide their eyes, and then the leader of the Seder hides that piece of matzah somewhere in the room. And then you go on with the Seder. Then later, after the meal, you let the children go look for this piece of matzah, which is wrapped in the linen cloth and hidden away. And they go all around. It's a lot of fun. They go around, and finally one of them finds it. Here, I've got it. And they bring it up. And then you give them some kind of an award or an applause. And I remember one year we bought a T-shirt that said, I found the Afikoman, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. But this is called the Afikoman, which is a Greek word. But they bring it back, and then we break that to pieces, we share it around, and we all take some of that. What's this a picture of? Yeshua. He's pierced. He's beaten and bruised. He's broken. He's wrapped in white linen. He's buried away. But then he comes back. He's unwrapped. There he is, alive and well, and still among us. But you know, you almost have to be a child to find him. You have to be childlike to find him, to encounter him. So let's take these words in red. We do not serve any dessert after the Pesach lamb. And let's look at what it says in Hebrew. Ein maftirin achar ha-Pesach afikomen. Ein means there is not, there is none. Maftirin, no, the last reader, when you have several readers come up to the Torah, the last reader reads the maftir, the conclusion. Maftir means the conclusion. So it means there is nothing concluding. There's nothing that comes after. Achar means after. ha-pesach afikoman. It's only five words, ha-pesach afikoman. After the Passover afikoman. That's what it says in Hebrew. Now, if you want to translate that, we don't serve dessert after the Passover lamb, you can. That's not what it's saying. He's saying, after the Passover afikoman, who's the Passover lamb? Yeshua. Who is the afikoman? Yeshua's resurrected body. After that, it's finished. There's nothing to do. Even buried in the words of the Haggadah is this witness about our Messiah. You know, I just like to be a fly on the wall at a Passover Seder after Yeshua returns. And they'll be reading the exact same Haggadah they've always read for centuries, and it's just going to be brand new to them. Here's the Messiah there. There's the Messiah there. Oh, there. Oh, four questions. Oh, and here's the four questions asked in Matthew 22. Oh, look, it's a wicked son. There's a wicked son. There's a clueless one. There's a wise one. It's all there. And again, I don't want to make more of this than what it is, but I love seeing connections between things. Things that you normally wouldn't expect to see connections between. But our God is God of the universe. He's everywhere. He has his hand in everything. And there's no question that in this ancient thing, and when Yeshua did his Last Supper, it was a Passover Seder. It says, I've longed to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. And to have been a fly on the wall at that one and hear the things he would have taught about himself. Wouldn't that be amazing? We have such an incredible God, such an amazing and wonderful Messiah. You know, God thought of everything, didn't he? He left nothing out. And he's buried little clues everywhere for us to discover. And like Proverbs says, it's the privilege of God to conceal a matter, and it's the privilege of a king to search it out. You know, as princes and princesses of the king, being royalty, we should be searching out the things of God in his scriptures. We want to know the scriptures and know the gevurah, the power of our God. We want to have both. We don't want to be like the Sadducees who are ignorant. We want to know his scriptures and know him. And that takes time and dedication. But after all, you don't belong to yourself anyway, do you? You're redeemed with a price. You don't belong to yourself. Deny your right to yourself. Give him what he's paid for. Give him your time. And love him with all your heart. And with all your soul. And with all your me'adecha, whatever those things are. Love him with them. Be lavish with your love towards him. He was lavish with his love toward you. And quit taking vengeance and bearing grudges against stupid little nitpicky stuff you think somebody did to you or didn't do that you deserved. Drop it. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's how Yeshua loves you. You don't be like him, then be like him for Pete's sake. Love people, they don't deserve it. Right? And we don't serve anything after the Passover afikoman. It is finished, he said. Last words he said until he said, into your hands I commit my spirit. Yeah, I was thinking of the song we sing in Hebrew. But into your hands I commit my spirit and gave up the ghost. Done. So, anyways, I hope there's something in all of this that spoke to you and you can put in your pocket, take with you, and put into effect. But you can start by just loving people, for Pete's sake. And loving them, not how they deserve, but loving the way you love yourself. You're pretty gracious with yourself, you know. So let's love one another gratuitously. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for the wonderful words of Matthew's gospel. And I pray that we would just be more committed to you. And Lord, we would ask questions all the time because we delight in the opportunity of drawing closer to you, of learning something more. But Lord, let us not ask questions like the wicked son to mock. And Lord, let us not be like the clueless son who doesn't ask at all. Help us to at least be like the simple son who says, Lord, what is this? Please teach me. Or like the wise son who can ask specific questions. Father, what is it you want from me? What can I do for you? What would please you that I can do? But most of all, let us always be asking the question Messiah asks. The Messiah, whose son is he? Let us never forget that. And we'll give you the praise and the glory for all that you do in our lives. For we ask it all in our Messiah Yeshua's name. Amen.